Internationally renowned negotiation and conflict resolution pioneer Erica Ariel Fox is going to provide us a forward-thinking approach to mastering the art of negotiations by mastering the negotiation within to get more of what you want and improve your relationships. Whether you're working with a difficult client, trying to get more from your team, or developing your highest leadership potential and value, this workshop will prepare you to lead, live, and create lasting change. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Erica Ariel Fox, a highly sought-after advisor in organizational effectiveness and executive development. In addition to her teaching at Harvard Law School, she has spent the past 2 decades working with senior teams worldwide through her global consulting firm, Mobius Executive Leadership. Her clients include Fortune 500 companies as well as the World Bank and the IFC. Ms. Fox serves as a senior advisor to McKinsey Leadership Development with a focus on culture transformation. Combining nearly 2 decades of experience with business leaders and a personal touch, she brings a unique voice to the conversation about leading wisely and living well. She's a LinkedIn influencer, blogs regularly for the Harvard Business Review, and lives with her husband and stepson outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and in Amsterdam. And I just recently found out that her book, Winning from Within, has recently been named a New York Times bestseller. So please join me in welcoming Erica Ariel Fox.
Thank you to Nuria and to Raytheon for bringing us here. Whenever I hear those introductions, I always feel they should do a little bit of the other side, such as, for example, in addition to these things, Erica is hopelessly terrible at catching up with her email. Her laundry is all over her house. She tries hard to pay her parking tickets, but that doesn't always work out. Just a more full picture of the human being underneath all these things. Very, very happy to be here with all of you. I speak in many settings to many conferences around the world, but there is always something unique and special about a gathering of women, and a gathering of this many women, 10,000 women strong. So congratulations to us for coming together. And in this setting, I feel at liberty to share a very funny story. A friend of mine a while ago is a mom with some young children, and she asked her young son, 6 years old, what he wanted for his birthday. And he said, Tampax. And she said, what? And he said, Tampax. So she said, honey, do you know what Tampax is for? He said, oh, yes. That's why I want it for my birthday. So she paused and said, what do you think you will do with this gift? He says, oh, with Tampax, you can do everything. Horseback riding, water skiing, run a marathon. It's like the ultimate gift of all activities in life that are fun. So I tell you this story in part because where else could you tell that story? But also because there's actually an aspiration in his birthday wish. And his aspiration, we could say, is to be free, to live fully, to experience everything his imagination can picture that he could do. And so he's fixated on a tool that he thinks will enable him to have a grand adventure in his life. Winning from within came about in my work and in my research in part because of my experience that many people, and I include myself, many very successful people, professional people, people who've raised 6 children, don't actually experience ourselves as truly free. We don't experience ourselves as free to choose, to speak up if we want to advocate for ourselves rather than only advocating for other people. We don't feel free often in the workplace to express emotion because we have a story in our head that will undermine us. We don't feel free to dream because a voice in our head tells us we can't afford it. So I became very interested and feel very passionate about a practical method that women and men can use at home and at work that has the effect of creating results and also has the ability to liberate, in some ways, more parts of who we are, to create more possibility for all of us in our lives, to horseback ride and water ski and do whatever we want. So what I want to talk to you about today is a method that comes from 20 years that I've spent teaching at the program on negotiation at Harvard Law School. To some extent, it's a negotiation method, but in many ways, it's a map of your inner life that equips you to live well, to love well, to lead well. It's not intended only to help you sell your house or buy a car or try to get a raise, although it is helpful in those contexts also. Negotiation, in this sense, really means the moment-to-moment experience you have every time you are trying to influence someone or they're trying to influence you. That happens when you try to get the person you live with to pick up the dry cleaning, since it's his turn and not yours. It happens when you try to figure out what movie to go to, and when you're trying to allocate resources on a team. Somebody wants this responsibility, someone says, that's my role, that's my turf, get out of here. When you're trying to align leaders on a strategy, every time you are trying to reach consensus or resolve conflict or pursue an opportunity to create value, that's all negotiation. So I started my career teaching getting to yes. How many people here are familiar with this? Everybody, right? It's a well-known book, and it has principles that are well-established as best practice. One of the core ideas in this book is the idea that if people know what they want, they can represent themselves at the table. So one of the big lessons here was helping people to find out their underlying interests so they could pursue them at the table. And I did a year-long study at the Boston Housing Court in landlord-tenant cases. These were eviction cases. The tenants did not have representation. The landlords did. And this was an experiment at the Boston Housing Court in bringing mediation into conflict resolution in landlord-tenant cases. And what I found, which probably won't surprise you, is that when tenants who were hanging in the balance about losing their home negotiated with landlords and their landlord's lawyer, even though they knew their interest, namely, not get kicked out of my home, they did not, in fact, assert their interests. They didn't. And over a year of interviewing them and recording transcripts of these mediation sessions, and I would, you know, speak to some of them, and I would say, you know, people here believe that you don't understand your legal rights. Is that why you didn't assert yourself? And they would say, no, I understand my legal rights. And I would say, you know, people here are concerned that you don't know what you should be asking for that would enable you to stay in the home, you know, a certain kind of payment plan over time. And they'd say, no, I understand. I know I could, you know, ask for a payment plan. So then why are you not speaking up for yourself at the table? And I heard many interesting things, which were often variations of, because you and I both know nobody here actually cares what I have to say. Or, because you and I both know that even if I ask for, you know, a kind of a plan that's going to enable me to stay in the house, it won't happen anyway, and I'll be so crushed when it doesn't work out, I'd rather just not try. So I became interested in the way that we get in our own way, that the beliefs we have about future outcomes, the stories we tell ourselves, Will the people at my office like me if I do that? Will the people here value my opinion if I speak up in dissent? Get in our own way from effective behavior. It's not as simple as if people know what they want and know their interests, then they're going to assert them. So I spent a bunch of time and I wrote an article, and at that time, the article focused on, as you would guess, an imbalance in power. And what I said at the time was, people who have less structural power are less likely to assert themselves than people who have structural power. But 10 years later, I came across an experience that really turned that idea on its head for me. And it happened when I was doing an exercise at Harvard. We run an executive education course there in the summer. It's an advanced course. There's one faculty with three participants. Some of you may have attended this course. And a person in my group was a Supreme Court justice. About the most powerful person in a society that you could meet, not a tenant sitting in the hallway of housing court, fearing eviction. And this person, in the exercise, was asked to bring a negotiation challenge, something that was hard for him. And I thought he would come up with some incredibly complicated intergovernmental dilemma, maybe how to stop ethnic cleansing. So it comes to his turn, and we ask him what scenario he's chosen to practice. By the way, he was not a U.S. Supreme Court justice, just to say. He was a high court judge from his own country. And he said, "I would like my wife to stop picking out my ties." I said, "Excuse me? I hate that. For 50 years, when I come out of the washroom, there it is. She's laid my whole outfit on the bed. Why does she do that?" So I asked him, a little sheepishly, "Have you ever asked her not to do that?" "That is exactly my problem. I cannot bring myself to ask my wife to stop picking out my ties, and I can't take it anymore." So here was the opposite, if you look up in terms of the theory of empowerment, right? It's easy to say people who are structurally disempowered will have trouble getting what they want, asking for what they need. Here you have a Supreme Court justice saying, "I can't make a request to my own wife, my spouse of 5 decades. That's not a structural societal power issue. Something else is going on. And the traditional lessons of getting to yes don't explain it. As I mentioned, that principal would say, if he knows what he wants and he knows his interests, then he'll assert them at the table. But as you can hear, he's not. So I became really interested in a new way of thinking about negotiation, which is not to focus so much on the other people across the table, but to understand that we are constantly negotiating with ourselves. So the tenant in housing court has a part of him that says, "I want to ask, you know, for a payment plan," but then another voice that says, "Oh, but they're going to say no, so just protect yourself, don't get hurt." Right? The judge might be saying, "I want her to stop doing this." There's a part of me that wants to set a line in the sand, but another part of me might what? What could be another part of him thinking? "I don't want to hurt her, right? Well, I've waited this long, how could I bring it up now?" You laugh, but we've all had that thought. And that's what I started to realize, that many times when we don't get the results we want, or we feel the relationship is breaking down, or the process isn't fair, although it's tempting to blame other people, we are actually falling short because we've got this conflict inside of ourselves. And as a result, there's a gap, what I call a performance gap, between what we really know we should do and what we actually do in real life. I will give you an example. I was very recently talking to my husband on Skype, which we do often because we live in two different countries. And I was talking to him and I was trying to be present and listen, but I was also, you know, stealthily checking my email on my phone. That did not go over well. And I look back and think, you know, I want to be an attentive partner. I do genuinely want to pay respect and be loving to my husband and listen to him. And another part of me has a really long to-do list, and I'm worried about not meeting deadlines. And I'm just, you know, I'm just scanning because that part of me wants to make sure, is there any emergency I need to attend to? And now there's a gap between the way I want to relate to my own spouse and what I'm actually doing, which is half listening and half checking my email. I know no one here understands what I'm describing. And actually, the way through that is not something that has to happen between him and me. It's between parts of me with other parts of me. So this method is about learning to negotiate with yourself first. If I had just paused for a minute and made a choice, which part of me is most important, I might have said, actually, it's the part checking messages. And then I could be honest and say, it's not a good time for me to talk. Right? Say, hello, I'm really in the middle of working, can we talk later? Or I might have chosen, as between these two, I really want to give him my attention, so I'm going to put the phone down. But because we don't identify the inner negotiators in ourselves, and we don't know how to help them build consensus, we end up stuck and we do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Do you know what I mean? The good news is there's actually a way out of that. The first thing is to notice that even though we often think of ourselves as me or you, there's enormous research from many different fields that tells us we are not actually as unified as we think. There are different parts of us. How many people here have heard the notion that you have a left brain and a right brain? Probably many people, right? And you know that the left brain and right brain operate completely differently. They take in information differently. They prioritize differently. So it turns out you have a left and right brain and a front and back of your brain. And each one of those quadrants functions differently. It has different priorities and values. It notices different things in the world and also gives you skills and capabilities to do different things. So what I've done to make this a model that people can use is look at those four regions of the brain and say, what are they best designed to do? Which inner negotiator is best supported by the capabilities of these four parts of our brain? And I call them the big four because we have many, many parts inside of us. Lots of other models give many, many names. Voice dialogue is one example, wonderful set of work that names many different sides of us. Because I work in many business environments, I found it more helpful to isolate four fundamental inner negotiators rather than give 25. So it's not that these are the only four, but I call them the big four because my experience is if you start experimenting with these four, you'll get a lot of traction quite quickly. So they are the thinker, the part of you that likes facts and logic, the dreamer, that's more about your imagination and possibility, the warrior, the part of you that gets things done, and the lover, which is a part of you that values relationship. I often talk about these as if they are a top team in a business. So you might have a team around you at the table. If you were in a business setting, it's as if you have a top team inside of you. You have an inner CEO, your own dreamer, who cares about possibilities. You have your own CFO who cares about perspectives, your own HR expert taking care of people, and your own chief operating officer who make sure you perform. Another image for this might be the idea that it's like a little democracy inside of us. We don't want to operate with a dictator who always takes the cautious route, or who always puts the relationship ahead of the result, or who always thinks things through forever and misses opportunities because you're still trying to make sure if it's too risky. That's letting your life be led by an inner dictator. This is a model of an inner democracy where you bring many voices to the table and you try to get the best result. There's, of course, a lot more information in the book, Winning from Within, to unpack these four. But my experience is that people can pretty quickly understand the idea that, again, you have your right and left brain, you have the limbic and cortex parts of the front and back of your brain, and the four inner negotiators that I'm talking about with you loosely map. Part of the reason that's so important to me is it underlies a basic idea, which is every single person in this room has all of the big four inside of you. Period. There are many tests and surveys that I've seen people use in business environments where people get put into a box. You know, you're the red people and the blue people and the yellow and the green, and everybody knows you're one of the yellow people. So if there's an opportunity for an inspirational speech, well, maybe they won't ask you because you're the yellow guy, which takes away the opportunity to grow and to develop and to tap strengths you may not have used yet, but you've got incredible potential to use in the future. So I embrace the idea we have tendencies, I agree that we have habits, but I reject the idea that anyone in this room is one or two of these and absolutely just don't have the other two. And by the way, people say this to me all the time. I don't have a thinker. I read the horoscopes. My husband thinks I'm insane. And I say, I believe you that you don't use your inner thinker very often. I believe you that you don't meet the world and look for facts and arguments and logic. I don't believe you are incapable of thinking something through. I don't. So, I feel really strongly about helping people get a feel for each of these four domains so that you can go forward into your own life looking for ways to expand the range of the big four that you use in everyday life. So I bring these examples as images of people who are very good at using their inner dreamer, using their inner thinker, using their inner lover, or their inner warrior. Now, this could be a little confusing because I just said you're not one of them, you're all four. But my purpose in showing you these icons is more to give you a feeling, a sense of these qualities so that you can think for yourselves. So for the next 3 minutes, I would like to ask you to turn to someone next to you, someone behind you, someone in front of you, say hello, and just reflect for a minute as you look at these four. Does anything come to your mind about your tendencies, not your personality, your tendencies? I am more likely to look for an emotional connection. I am more likely to have a big dream, even if it's unrealistic. I'm more likely to say, can we afford this? I'm more likely to say, I just want to get it done. What are the action steps? Do we need to actually, like, hear how everybody's weekend was? Can we just, like, do the agenda? Everybody had a good Thanksgiving. Moving on. That's the warrior, in case that wasn't clear. So take 2 or 3 minutes with someone next to you and just muse. Think of some examples in your life that you think show where do you hang out more among these big four. Is there any of the big four that you say, yeah, I just don't ever operate like that? A few minutes on your own. Okay, 1 minute warning. Okay, let's come back together. Yes. Oh. Great. So, I would like to give you a little bit more content around the Big Four, and then I will have time so that we can have questions and discussion. And so there's a microphone here and a microphone here if you had any insights during that time or questions in general. I promise you that we will have time for that as well. So where do the Big Four come from, and why did I choose these four of the infinite range of qualities of the human experience? One answer is that I studied many, many cultures across time and space, meaning over many different centuries and in different parts of the world, all of whom created systems to express the basic core of human experience. They did this before the internet, so they did not communicate with each other. They actually independently generated these systems. And what I found, when you drill down underneath those systems, some from indigenous people, some from great philosophers, some from poets, from psychologists, I found an incredible pattern. It shows up also in popular culture, in fairy tales, the same four elements. So I honed in on them because they're so recognizable. And for those of you who are interested, the fancy term for these recognizable inner negotiators is archetypes, as many of you know. And the notion of an archetype is it's a part of us that is inborn. We don't have to learn about it in order to understand it. So when you came into the world, no one had to teach you how to tell your heart to beat. You knew how to do that. So Carl Jung's idea, and Joseph Campbell after him, their belief is that there are certain archetypes that are not about how the physical body operates, but how the interior life of human beings operate, that are also inborn. They are recognizable to us from the moment that we come into physical life. And the reason why these four, dreamer, lover, thinker, and warrior, are so powerful when you start to embrace them is because they are so fundamental and so universal. So I want to share this image for you as just one of countless examples of a story that is really, in my interpretation, a story about claiming all of the Big Four. Has anyone any idea where this image comes from? By the way, I can't use this in Europe because people actually have not seen the movie. It's really interesting. It doesn't mean anything to them. So, who is in this story? The way that I would tell it is in the following way. This is a story about a girl, a young woman, going on a journey. She's going on a journey down the yellow brick road to find herself, to reclaim herself, her wholeness. She goes down the yellow brick road with three companions. Each one of these four traveling fellows represents one of the big four. So if we look at the scarecrow, you remember the scarecrow is going to see the wizard. Why? Wants to get a brain. He says his head is full of straw, and he's going to find his brain. A psychologist might say he has a disowned thinker, or his thinker is in shadow. It's out of his sight. His experiences, like some professionals who I work with, I just don't have a thinker, but I'm going to go there and get one. Then you have the Tin Man. He says, I bang on my chest and it's empty. There's no heart. The disowned lover. He's going down the yellow brick road to get his heart because he needs his lover. He doesn't want to live his life without intimacy and connection. We have the lion. Is this a courageous lion? No, this is a cowardly lion. The disowned warrior. The lion should be the king of the forest, but this lion is afraid of his own shadow. So he says, I need to reclaim my warrior. I need to go find my courage so I can be who I fully am. And Dorothy, of course, the dreamer, somewhere over the rainbow, right? There's a place that I dream of. She has a dream of going home. Her whole journey down the yellow brick road is about, I want to go home. She expresses it as Kansas. I want to go home and I don't know how. I'm a dreamer, but I've lost the capacity to fulfill my dream. So I need to go see this wizard and learn from the outside how I can make this dream come true. So we have our big four players. A few things that I think are very interesting about this story. Most importantly, how many people, as you look at this image, how many people are going down the yellow brick road? Only one. There's one woman. She is going down the yellow brick road to find herself, to find her wholeness. So I would suggest these are not four independent creatures. These are four representations of parts of Dorothy. They are all Dorothy. There's one person going down the road, and she has symbolized her lost lover, her lost thinker, her lost warrior. She herself, embodying her lost dreamer, essentially she is saying symbolically, I've lost every essential part of who I am. And I'm going to go on this journey to see this magical wizard to get myself back. Has anybody here ever had the feeling of being lost? Or I can't even remember. Like, I used to be a really cool person. What happened to me? Well, that's the archetypal story. We get lost and we get found. We come back to ourselves. We lose ourselves and we come back. A very important piece of this story is what the wizard actually does for the characters. And what does the wizard actually do? Basically nothing. What does the wizard actually give them from the outside? Some symbols and a diploma, but the message of the wizard in this story is you have all of the big four, you've had it all along. You could never not have your own dreamer, your own lover, your own thinker, your own warrior. You can never not have them. You can never need some wizard from the outside to give them to you. His role is to hold up a mirror and bless them and say, you have had these qualities all along. And the minute that you know that, all you have to do, click, click. The minute that you awaken to the range of who you really are, Dorothy, click your heels and you're there. So I think this is a very important message for us because it's very easy to get focused on structural obstacles and structural achievements. Did I get the promotion? Am I getting a raise? She got a bonus and I didn't. Why am I not running that project? Look at what happened to these women who didn't take off time when they were raising children, and I can never catch up. These are measures outside in the external world that we use to measure our success, our fulfillment, our manifestation. But this is an invitation to say, how am I on the inside, fully meeting life, fully giving expression to who I am, allowing all these parts of myself to serve me, my work, my communities, my family? I don't need something from the outside world to tell me that I'm okay, or to tell me that I'm alive, or that I'm doing a good job. A way to think about that would be, am I being true to myself? Am I allowing all the different parts of myself to shine? And I'll tell you, in my experience of working with thousands and thousands of people around the world, the vast majority of people embrace one or two of the big four and reject the others. They identify as a problem solver, or as an entrepreneur and a visionary, or I'm a people person, and they create what I call their profile, which becomes a story they tell about themselves that they use to cut themselves off from life. And I'll give you an example of my own version of this. Many years ago, I had been dating for a while, like 20 years or so, and I hadn't met anybody, I hadn't met the right person, and I met a wonderful guy who happened to live in the Netherlands. And I thought, see, I need to meet a guy exactly like him who lives in New York, and then I'll be set. And even though I thought he was a fabulous guy, I refused to date him because I had a story in my head called, I'm never gonna live in Europe, so what is the point? Then I hit my 40th birthday, and I thought, you know, I've actually been in relationships for more than 20 years, and I have never had the quality of connection and understanding and joy that I have when I spend time with this person. It's a story that I'm telling myself that I would never live in Europe. It's a picture that is different from any way I've ever pictured my life since I started seeing myself as an adult. I never thought about living in Europe. But at some point I came to realize this story that I'm telling about myself is actually preventing me from experiencing something I really very much want, which is an intimate relationship with a partner. So that took, you know, like 3 years, by the way, even though it took 10 seconds right now. But I eventually married that guy, and I have a life that I would have never pictured. I go back and forth between Amsterdam and Boston, quite a lot. However, the decision to not let that profile, the story I told about who I am and what my life is gonna look like, the decision to say, that's not a truth, it's a story. And the author of that story is me. I can choose to tell a different story, like, maybe it's worth a shot. And what I've discovered in working with the big four is that incredible opportunities open up for you if you allow yourself to stop the message that any one of these, quote, are just not you. It's just not how I am. Because that's a decision that you're making. And I honor that you probably have some strengths and some limitations. You've got things that you're good at and things you're not good at. But at some point, you want to look at the ways you cause yourself pain and ask, is this really the way to go? I had a law student who came and told me right around this time of year last year that she went home. She was celebrating the holidays with her family. She was incredibly exhausted. She'd been helping with, you know, the nieces and nephews and cooking. She'd been up all night before she had come home, preparing for school, and when she got home, her mother had an incredibly long list of requests. She would need to be wrapping presents, they need help to put up the tree, they need to clean up the guest room for people coming for Christmas, and she said, and in my head I wanted to scream, I cannot do one more thing, I have to go to sleep. But she is so identified with being a lover, being a relationship person. She said, of course, Mom, you tell me what you need me to do. And she said, about 3 hours later, she fell into her bed. She was just sobbing from self-neglect. So I bet her mother might have understood if she had let herself bring out the warrior and say, you know how much I love you and love the family, but right now I need to go to sleep. So let's do it in the morning. No one told her that she couldn't say that except for herself. So the last thing I want to say, and then open it up to some questions. Even though we've talked about the big four so far this whole session, it is worth mentioning that you are also more than your big four. We have essential parts of who we are. And again, this is represented in different language by every philosophical, spiritual, psychological tradition. Internal family systems, if people are interested in that, talks about this as the self. You could also talk about this as inner light, as a connection to God, as love, unconditional love. But we all have a kind of a core that's beyond the big four. And one of the ways to get skillful at managing the pulls and pushes of the four is to learn more about how can you find your way to a place in your own center that connects you to a truth for you that can serve as a compass as you make your way through the world. I put this picture because these are the women doing the Avon breast cancer walk, and they represent to me the integration of all of the big four, the dream of curing breast cancer, the thinking that will come from the research, the community of support of people coming together, and the plain walking 40 miles for 2 days, dreamer, thinker, lover, warrior, all playing a role in order to achieve a very important goal. So these closing words of advice, just to pull it together, I really urge you, I bless you, encourage you to explore all of your big four. It's not all or nothing. You don't have to go out of here and say, well, I've been a warrior my whole life, so starting today, that's done. I'm just going to go love everybody, and in the end of year performance reviews, just love them up. No, your warrior's online because it's helping you. It's a good thing. This doesn't make any of your parts bad. It's just inviting you to find a way every part can add value. I also would say if you want to experiment, which I encourage, you don't want to pick the single most important conversation you've avoided for the last 19 years as your first shot of trying to blend lover and warrior. You want to find some low-risk experiments where it won't matter that much if it doesn't go well, but that's how you learn over time. So I wanted to just tell you, as it was mentioned earlier, I'm going to be around all day in that exhibit hall. We have a booth. Love for you to come visit. Also, if you want to, you can follow me on LinkedIn because I'm often blogging and happy to share those ideas. In the meantime, would love to hear for a few minutes comments or questions, insights, the reactions. As I said, there's a microphone here and a microphone here. Yes.
Hi, Erica. Thank you for being here today. I have a question about how you might be able to negotiate your inner people in different settings. So I think I'm more of a person that is a warrior and a thinker at work, and at home I'm the lover and the what's the other one?
Dreamer,
thank you. So I'm just kind of wondering, do you have some thoughts on how, you know, as a woman you can negotiate those? That might not be very unusual. You know, I see some heads nodding, so.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is, if you have patterns like that, they are working for you in some ways and not working for you in others. You wouldn't keep that pattern going if it was only harmful. However, to get better results, you're going to need to change it up a little. So if you can just start to notice, oh, we're having this interaction at work, and I'm doing what I always do, thinker, warrior. I wonder, dreamer, lover, you have anything you want to say? you know, I'm here at home, I'm trying to get my kid, you know, off, no more screen time. I usually come from my lover, my dreamer at home. That's what I'm doing now, being a little soft. Is there anything my warrior or thinker might like to say or do right now to get a better result at home? So start to notice the habits you have, and just in those moments, ask. I'm doing my same old, could I try to ask one of the others to weigh in?
Okay, thank you.
Yep, over here.
Hi, so I work with the 3% Conference, and we're often talking about women's perceptions, how women are perceived in our roles within our career. I don't know if you go into this in your book, and I'll get it and read about it, but in the meantime, I'm curious. Something that we talk about is that women are often expected to take on dreamer and lover roles, right? We maintain the relationships and, you know, maybe we have ideas, but we're not really expected to be in the warrior or thinker roles. Do you talk about this in your book? Is this a norm across industries? And how can women in the workplace exert more of our warrior and more of our thinker in a way that feels appropriate and helps us climb the ladder and be more effective?
So I would agree that there have been very traditional expectations of women and men in the workplace, but my experience in the last 5 years working with many businesses is that there's a real premium right now on authenticity, on authentic leadership, and being present, and being fully who you are. And my experience is that if we all shift out of the story that says they don't want us to be like that, they don't want us to be like this, and say, actually, I've been invited to show up authentically as who I am, all of my strengths and my limitations, and if those happen to be warrior thinker strengths, and that's my truth and highest contribution, go for it. And when you hear yourself saying, oh, but people won't like it if I do that, just say, you know what? That's an old story. I'm going to be authentic. And that's what I believe actually is invited at the moment in the business world.
I hope you're right.
One more question?
So this is actually very similar to the last question that was asked. But as a student, it might not apply to everyone here. But especially for interviews and, you know, when you are networking and people ask you, you know, what are your strong suits? And, like, for work, definitely I would go for, like, really strongly on my thinker and warrior traits. But then do you recommend going off of all four of them, or is that too broad? Are you spreading yourself too wide?
My advice, which wouldn't surprise you, would be if you have time over the course of the interview to tell a story or example that shows you thinking and using good judgment, getting things done, a time that you valued a relationship or had an impact by showing someone, you know, you appreciated them or you had employees get more engaged by relating to them, and some experience of having a dream and going for it. Yes, my belief would be the more you can demonstrate you have some capacity in all four. That's not true for every interview, but yeah. I have a LinkedIn post I posted a month ago saying, use the big four in your job interviews. So okay. I have to send it to you.
All right. Thank you.
So I want to invite Nuria to come. I know she wanted to make a closing remark, and then we will move on to the book signing. Thank you guys so much. We have closing remarks before we finish.